items that don't require the quorum.
Okay.
We can just kind of maybe work through some of those, and then when they do get here, then we can vote on those.
Okay. So welcome, everybody, to our Traffic Safety Commission meeting here in Seattle. Kind of nice to tag on to the conference. I want to start off by recognizing and thanking Darren and your staff for an amazing conference. I heard a lot of really positive things about the breakout sessions and the speakers and just the exchange of information from a diverse group of traffic safety partners. So you guys did a great job, so we expect even better next year. So the expectation is, every 2 years?
Every 2 years, yeah.
So the expectation, the bar is very high.
Yes, it is.
It's great to see your attendance at the conference was a great level to be set at that bar. So good job.
Thank you.
So with that, I'll move on to everybody know everybody. I think we all know each other around the table, right? We don't have a quorum yet. Will we have a quorum when she gets here?
We will be just one shy of a quorum. Sandy was advised she was going to be here, but I'm not sure. I haven't heard back from her yet. So
will we be able to, should we go to the 2016 legislative session? Because I think the next two items on the agenda require a quorum.
Yeah, just wanted to let you know that as far as the 2016 legislative session, we have, obviously, with the approval of this body, is we put forward the distracted driving legislation again. We had to submit that by September 24th to OFM, so that can go through the governor's approval process. It's very much what it was when it ended last session, but there's some discussion about some language in there that may be changed. I think there was some kind of that last minute, you know, if we add this, we add this. And now when you go back, it's not real clear. So we'll be working through that process. But we do have it as a placeholder, so we can go into the 2016 session with that bill. There's obviously lots of discussion about there's no money. So we did not put any forward any supplemental for the Traffic Safety Commission this session, particularly with the, I think there's a $3.5 billion hole because of the increases in potential teacher salaries. And then with the McNary decision, there's some things that are there. So, you know, as state agencies, we were asked, you know, be very judicious about any types of requests. So we didn't have any need at this point to move forward. From the 2015 legislative session, I'll just give you an update. We will be going out, or we have out an announcement, and we have actually an advertisement on the registration desk for the Pedestrian Fatality Review Council. We have a program manager that will be coming in. It's a half-time employee, and that is open, I think, through the end of November. And then, it is until filled. And so we've only had, I think, approximately 3 applicants at this point, and we would like to see a very competitive pool for that. We've actually had a nurse that's retiring that has put forward some interest. It would be nice to have somebody that comes from the kind of that trauma background that might be helpful for that, but it's only a half-time employee. So the other thing is that in the 2015 session, the bill that incorporated reducing the felony DUI from 5 to 4 we thought it was going to get resuscitated through the third special session. Actually, it got kind of brought up on all, but we thought it was going to pass. But that particular bill would provide an FTE for the impaired driving program, as well as a $50 increase to the BAC fee, which is already $25, so then it would be a total of $75. So that would be funds that could come in to the Traffic Safety Commission to use for impaired driving programs. So that is something we are considering, or actually hoping, gets brought forward again. Senator Patton is here at the conference. I believe it was his bill that he had pushed forward. So we're hoping to see some of that coming up, because we would love to have an additional program manager. Because we are, all the things that we're managing right now, we have kind of reached almost a level of bandwidth that, you know, it's hard to take more and more on. So,
Darren, is he the only legislator that was at the conference?
No, we had Representative Goodman was here yesterday, and I don't know if he was going to come back today, but he was here yesterday. Senator Patton's been here, and then Jackson Maynard, who is, correct me, is it?
Staff counsel to the majority coalition, I think, or something, and he supports the transportation and law and justice committees.
Yes, yeah.
So Senator Patton, and he works a lot with Senator Patton, Senator King.
Yeah.
And then I met another staff person that was bipartisan here today at lunch or at breakfast, and she was here from the Senate side too.
And we have on Tuesday morning, we had Charles Knutson was here. Actually, I'm sorry, Tuesday afternoon when we started, we had Charles Knutson from the governor's office, who his area is over transportation as well. So we've had some really good representation.
Right.
So the 2016 session, I think, is going to pose, obviously, some interesting challenges. The focus crosshairs don't seem to be on traffic safety issues, but Shelley Baldwin, who is our legislative liaison, has really been working behind the scenes this session, especially in the distracted driving, as well as working with a representative out of Vancouver, specifically working on young drivers and looking at how we can address the young drivers. Your staff's been involved heavily with that, Brady. And so looking at how do we, are there licensing issues, are there driver training issues, are some things that maybe we could affect through some legislation that have shown some promise in other areas and jurisdictions that we could bring here to Washington to affect the young drivers. So the... I think that's pretty much it for right now. Distracted driving, impaired driving, and I think that's it for right now for the 2016 legislative updates.
Is there any news on the federal side that you want to share?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff on the federal side. What we're seeing is obviously the Highway Trust Fund is still continually struggling. They keep having to add additional funds from the general fund into the Highway Safety Fund to continue the NHTSA, get a continuing resolution. So we'll have funding up through, what we will receive up through December 11th, 2015. Their offices are struggling because they haven't received, they've got authority, actually appropriation authority, but not authority yet. So Congress is working through that piece right now. So those are some issues that, just on the funding piece of it. I hope that they can put together a six-year budget plan for transportation, but we're continuing to see that just kind of getting pushed and pushed and pushed. So it looked like we were maybe going to have something. The Senate had passed something out. The House is now continually, they're trying to revise some different proposals. The big part of it is where are we going to get the funds to do that. So that affects both the infrastructure piece as well as the behavioral piece. So those are things that we are watching pretty closely. I have been in communications with Sam Ricketts, who is the governor's Washington, kind of the liaison in D.C. for the governor. And so he puts out quite a few updates. And then with the Governor's Highway Safety Association, when I get those, I try to kind of filter out some of the stuff that's more relevant, and then I try to send that out to you so you can kind of see what's happening on the national level and potentially the impacts it has on us at the state level. So the NHTSA continues to be focusing on, they're now focusing on four primary areas. Dr. Mark Rosekind at the American Association of Motor Vehicles Administrators Conference and the Governor's Highway Safety Association Conference said, I know we have the three Ds, and that's drug, drunk, and distracted. He says, but through our research, and his background is in sleep deprivation, sleep therapy, sleep research, and so he says, I would like us to start looking at our data more closely at drowsy driving. He says, from a federal perspective, he says, when we look at our data, he says, our estimate is that 20% of the fatals in our country are related to drowsy driving. So over at Washington State University is Dr. Brian always forget how to pronounce his last name, but it's Vila. I think it's Vila or Vila. And he was a former police officer, former police chief, went back, got his doctorate in psychology. He's done a lot of different things in with sleep studies. He has an entire sleep, pretty state-of-the-art sleep study over at WSU, and their focus has been on law enforcement and the impacts that shift, you know, different shifts and the impacts and stress on law enforcement officers. And so he actually presented at our Governor's Highway Safety Association conference this year in Nashville, and then he and I have had some conversations. How do we now take it from the law enforcement realm and bring it into the, you know, everybody realm, and really talk about that driving, that fatigue that you have, and making those decisions not to drive when you feel fatigued, or what you need to do when you do feel fatigued. Some people kind of just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. So age has an impact, right? You know, sleep, stress of the job, all those different things. And so great resources that we have just in our own state that I didn't even know Brian existed until this year. And so it's just kind of nice to see. So seeing from the national level, here also a state level, and some of the resources that we have. So it's going to be the drug, drunk, drowsy, and distracted is the four D's that National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is admonishing states to really take a look at. It's hard from collision data, because if the officer can't determine specifically, the person doesn't self-disclose, yeah, I fell asleep, or witnesses said, looked like he was asleep, it's hard to know. On the collision report, it has a thing, apparently asleep, or you just put unknown, and that is a challenge for the officer, just like distracted driving. So it is underreported. So,
Darren,
yeah.
Is that because when you're, if you admit that, you're adding some culpability and some liability legally?
Absolutely.
Because if you can just say, oh, I just, you know, I wasn't paying attention, or I don't know what happened, I drifted off the road, that's one thing. But if you say, you know, I've been sleep deprived, I nodded off. So it seems like a really hard one to get accurate data on, but it makes a lot of sense. That's a big factor.
It is. And then the insurance companies are going to want to know, well, how come you just kind of like went from this lane, you know, we refer to those as the run off the road, but how did you end up clear over here? And I, as a trooper, I had those several times. As a young adult at the age of 18, I drove into a median. We'd been working all day. It was hot in summer. Drove into the median and flat tires. I cannot believe to this day that we didn't roll the car. And we came out, and at that time, I was in Utah. So the trooper rolled up, says, "You boys okay?" He said, "We're good. Just changing the tires." All right. Drove away. So, you know, that's like 1985, 86.
And it wasn't in Murray.
And it wasn't in Murray. It was just coming into Salt Lake. That's before they put the Murray medians in. But the thing is it's how, you know, the officers themselves, especially local officers, you know, they may not, you know, ask some of those questions. So, but those are kind of some things that we're seeing from the national level. I'll talk about in my director's report a little bit about the drug report that came out. But they are working on another drug report. And we have been working feverishly to get the Pacific Institute of Research and Evaluation roadside survey data. There's been some issues between NHTSA and Fire, kind of some changing of the guard at Fire, and so we're trying to get the data so that we can get that out to you so you can see what's happening around the state. Major heroin issue is what we've been hearing. I mean, that's no surprise. We've been hearing that a lot here at the conference. Marijuana is a little bit of an issue, but the data is too early to say definitively, you know, are we seeing an increase? And so we're being very cautious about that. We have a report that will be coming out at the end of October that will be more of a descriptive report, lots of charts and graphs and things, and addressing kind of what we're seeing in our data. But drug driving is eclipsing alcohol-only fatals. But we're seeing the synergistic effect between the drugs and the alcohol, marijuana, you know, and then the variety and the prescription drugs and the impacts that alcohol's having. So,
can I add
something
or make a suggestion? Maybe I guess mm-hmm. I sat in this morning just prior to this meeting on the young adult driver behavior. Let's change it. Pull out. They had some interesting statistics, and you're talking about the young drivers. Well, because we have fairly rigorous requirement that they go through driver's ed and so forth, the statistics for 16 through 17 plus drivers was very low. The problem area is the person who waits until they're 18 years old, doesn't have to go through a program, and can go and just sign up, take the test, get the driver's license, and off they go. And so what I'm suggesting is that you look at some of those statistics that are coming out of the Department of Licensing has them. This Brady Horenstein, mm-hmm. are you familiar with yeah. him? Anyway, he provided all, is that a he or a she?
It's a he.
Okay. Anyway, all this really great information. Of course, when you start doing statistics and you start picking apart, well, does that mean this or that, or this kind of thing? But anyway, the 18 to 24-year-olds are where the problems are happening. And a lot of that is because they just got there, you know, they're 21, so they can, now they're drinking legally or driving illegally. And all this stuff is happening. So when we start talking about legislation, we shouldn't just talk about the 16-year-olds. It sounds to me like that's taking care of itself. It's maybe requiring some other things from the 18 to 24-year-olds. Anyway.
Which is what we're looking at. The Traffic Safety Commission gave us grant money this year, though, to expand the knowledge test. So it's going to go to 40 questions as a result of the money the Traffic Safety Commission gave us. And then we found a little bit of, we didn't get all the money we asked for, so we put in some agency resources to be able to up the questions to 40.
Mm-hmm.
We can do changes to the knowledge test and to the skills test without legislation. So that's an opportunity to look at that. And maybe one of the things, like in the UK, that they did was they forced more stringent testing,
right?
And didn't mandate the training, but because the testing was so much more challenging, people ended up taking the training, which might be a better way of looking at that. Because if we were to increase training responsibility, that would take statutory change.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Obviously you're well aware of this whole thing, but they look, you know, worldwide to see where they're finding the fewest accidents, the fewest fatalities. And the UK was one of them, and it was because the testing is so hard to get a license that they figured that has to be what it is. But anyway, I figured, hey, great resource. You know.
Yeah, we actually we're going to look at additional traffic safety funds for the future to look at all that area of testing. But they had, at the end, some really good brainstorming of things to look at for adult drivers, young adult drivers, and ideas that came about in the discussion. So it was a good session.
Good. Yeah, and I know the work group has been working with the representative out of Vancouver. These are some very specific things that they're talking about, because the idea is, when you look at the data, it's the 18 to 34-year-olds that we have with SEEK repeatedly in the data. But when the licensing piece of it and the crashes, you see that 18 to 24-year-old that's heavily involved. And then, we do see a lot of 18-year-olds that are waiting. And what about people that are coming in from other countries that have never had that, you know? So there's, I think there's a lot of issues around that piece, and how do we help to bolster it?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why. Somebody said, well, it's the cost of taking the class and so forth. I actually have my third child, my older son, he just could never fit the class in. He was always involved in so many athletic sports, and he wasn't necessarily one that would get up in the morning and take a 6:30 class. So he just basically waited and drove and rode around with his friends until he was 18. Then he went and took the class, I mean, the test. So it was not a matter of that he couldn't afford to do it. It was just that he didn't have the time carved out in his life at that point.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's the commercial driver schools, and then you have the ones that are still associated with the high schools.
Right.
And those are very far and few between. But, you know, some of the different requirements, and, you know, I remember growing up, you know, going into class, and we had little tiny simulators. In 85, we had these little dinky, you know, weird, there she is. Oh, I was just going to call you.
Oh, no.
So
do we have a quorum?
We do have now a quorum.
Okay.
So...
All right, so let's go back up to the approval of the minutes for April 16th and July 16th. Any comments, edits to the minutes of July 16th?
I make a motion to approve April and July minutes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Let's move on to Oh, I did it backwards. I'm sorry. The April 16th, 2015 minutes. Any?
I believe that was included in his motion, wasn't it?
Was it both?
Sorry, I'm so impatient.
Okay, both. Okay, thank you for
keeping me straight.
You're
welcome. That's all right.
Okay, then we can move on. So let's move on to approval of the pedestrian bike project proposal. I think we all have a letter from Lynn. Is that connected to this, right?
Yes.
Okay. And John, do you want to say any?
Sure. Give a little background. If you go back to the April commission meeting when you all approved the grants for federal fiscal year 16, Secretary Peterson asked that for the opportunity for a little bit more time to do a little bit of outreach to see if there were any other opportunities from a pedestrian safety perspective. And so as you approved the grants, it was amended with the motion to allow consideration of that. Since then, we worked with the Traffic Safety Commission, I think from two perspectives. One, looking at the data across the state to see what that told us, and then kind of combining that with where do we think the opportunities are for success in terms of a project. That led us to Spokane, where they're doing a lot of good things from a pedestrian safety perspective. And you have the proposed project as one of the handouts. It really builds on work that's already going on in Spokane. They had passed an ordinance focused on establishing crosswalks and different features associated with crosswalks and different applications in the city. Met with staff from DOT as well as Traffic Safety Commission, met with city staff and the Target Zero manager, and to look at what other additional opportunities might there be to build on that program that's already in place. The group came up with basically this proposal that brings more ability for heightening awareness through use of media, additional enforcement opportunity relative to the applications, and from a broader perspective, allows the ability to look at some of the things in the different treatments and combination of treatments, I think really to then take the successes of that and look for application broader across the state. I know that's big for us, DOT, as we're looking at different pedestrian treatments, signing and marking, as well as combining with awareness. And so we think that this has the opportunity to kind of really broaden the view in terms of how we apply different treatments from a statewide standpoint. And so this is the description. Here, is it okay if I read a letter from Secretary Peterson in, and that's also, you should have a copy of that. Secretary writes, "Dear Traffic Safety Commissioners, my apology for not being with you today. I had a prior commitment out of state that made it impossible for me to join you in considering this important topic. I appreciate the opportunity to provide my thoughts and enthusiastic support for the Spokane Pedestrian Safety Zone project through this letter. First, I want to thank my fellow commissioners for allowing extra time to develop an additional pedestrian safety project. I appreciate the Traffic Safety Commission's inclusive process, as well as the opportunity to help guide this important effort. Pedestrian safety is a Target Zero priority too. Pedestrian safety is one of our priority areas that has not seen a reduction in fatalities or serious injuries. To ensure the continued development of a true multimodal transportation system, we must continue to find ways to make it safer and easier for people walking to move through our system and to effectively access other transportation options. I support this project because it brings together engineering, education, and high visibility enforcement efforts to address pedestrian safety. Thank you to Traffic Safety Commission staff for their efforts in developing this important project. Spokane is a great location and a willing participant to test concepts and share results. Our hope is that we will see significant improvements in pedestrian safety that we can share with others around the state. Again, I fully support this project and want to thank you all for allowing and fostering its development and for your consideration in moving it forward. The Department of Transportation is committed to helping make it successful. Sincerely, Lynn Peterson."
I'd just like to say I support this effort. We're experiencing an increase in problems with car pedestrian fatalities, in particular on our interstate systems with the homeless community. In Kings, the homeless, and over in the Spokane area, but we've had a major problem here in King County with homeless people sleeping along the interstate system, and unfortunately there's a heavy use of drugs associated with their community, and they end up on the freeway and they're struck and killed. So we need to do something about that. Our captain here in this district is really struggling with that in terms of how to find solutions to it. Whatever we can do to assist is going to be important. help us save lives. Also, this is a little bit of history. You know, we actually had a pedestrian safety committee within DOT, WSP years ago, and we worked with local stakeholders, and we actually focused here on 99 because we were having lots of crossover collisions. People failing to use the actual marked crosswalks. And so DOT did a lot of study, and we actually ended up doing some traffic safety improvements along the corridor and working with the local communities.
Well, Chief, too, you mentioned it along freeway types of facilities, and that's something we're looking at, too, and can follow up with you.
Yeah.
And your staff on looking at what are ways that we can be addressing that. It's kind of a unique set of circumstances, but when you look at the data, it really shows up.
I just wanted to comment, and City Spokane is thrilled to be considered for this grant. We're just really gratified to have Secretary Peterson's support and the support of WatchDOT staff, and also the support of the commission and commission staff. You know, I watched the presentation from the City of Seattle yesterday about some of their built environment changes they're doing, and I just have to laugh at the amount of money they have to spend compared to most other cities in Washington. Their resources are really on a different level. We hope this money will help us focus in on using limited resources to achieve results. I've been telling Darren, I think we have a good, decent trend for pedestrian fatals in Spokane, but this year we've seen a spike. And we have 5 bike ped deaths already this year, which is completely unacceptable. And so we are looking for every resource we can to impact that. We just passed a street levy last year, which means we have new resources to improve street safety that we haven't had in the past. And this is the first year of us being able to put some of that resources out there. So the timing couldn't be better. Also, our health department is also running a kind of a traffic safety related campaign at the same time. So it's a really good synergy that's going on. So we're thrilled to be considered for this.
Is your focus on the downtown area, or is it up Division Street, or what? Or is it all over the just within the city limits?
So it's interesting. I am a recipient of the political pressure involved with the fatal, and so we have certain areas where if it's a more affluent, you know, victim, and it's embedded in more of a middle-class neighborhood, there's more of a rush to you know, find a solution or have a public meeting. But then we have a lot of the kind of fatals that you're describing, where there's nobody coming forward. There may not even be a family member that we can locate, and it's a, you know, it's 2 column inches in the newspaper.
Which is usually right downtown.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so one of the things that has been really helpful from the commission is I just received this week a heat map with some new software that they're working on, because it's really hard for me. I mean, I've been on the council 6 years. I don't have all that history kind of embedded. They were able to come up with a fatal and injury crash heat map for the entire city of Spokane over the last 10 years or so, and it really helps me go out and kind of, you know, have some kind of reality check on where our problems are occurring. So I just got that, and it's fascinating, and I look forward to sharing it with folks and maybe having it be a part of what we discuss in implementing this.
I will also add that over in the Yakima area, particularly for the Yakima tribe, there's an overrepresentation within their community of carped fatality collisions that we have to investigate. A lot of them walk on the reservation, and unfortunately many of them under the influence, and they end up being struck and killed on the reservation. So we have partnered with the Yakima Nation in attempts to address that issue. So anything we can do to further that is going to be beneficial for everyone.
Any more discussion?
I did want to point out just one thing. On the grant, on what I handed out, it shows the Department of Transportation as the recipient. I don't think that's really the intention. The intention of this is for the funding to be with in the hands of the locals. And so I think between Darren, your staff, and us to work out, and the group to work out who is actually the direct recipient.
We don't care as long as we get the money.
Well, yeah, I just want to make sure that we do that the most efficient way. And so I think that's just a detail for us to work
out. Who's administering the grant, you know?
Well, I think that's part of the,
right.
really what
I believe did. It's our city staff. We're the lead
then,
on
then
that.
That's my understanding,
yeah.
too. And so I just want to point that out.
No, we don't. But we have a streets department.
Is that coming into Karen, the Target Zero manager, to help facilitate that, or is that which is the agreement that we'd have somebody?
That's a good question. That's probably a loop we need to close.
Yeah, because I think that was just as far as facilitation of the funds was going to come in, and then she
that
was going to work because she's with Public Works
in the county. She doesn't work for the city.
Okay.
So
my apologies. Yes.
That's why we probably just need to discuss.
Okay.
Sure, it'd be easy to figure out.
Yes.
So can we have a motion to approve the pedestrian bike project proposal?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed?
Wondering if maybe you should abstain.
If he abstains, is it a quorum?
No, that's a good idea.
But obviously, you don't need it. But I'm just trying
okay?
to.
Oh, yes. Okay. But we do have Secretary Peterson's letter of approval, so we can have that as it's been read into the record, and
okay.
we have a quorum.
And isn't it abstaining? Isn't like he left the room?
Right. It's just there's a conflict
there.
Still present,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I can change my vote to an abstention.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the agenda item, the AMVA motorcycle program. So in 2015, we won a PACE award for a project that was funded by the Traffic Safety Commission, and it was focused on, I think we showed it here at one of the commission meetings, was focused on a lot about the young driver and being more aware, have more awareness around motorcycles when they're on the roadways to make sure that we're ensuring their safety on the roadways. And so that won a regional award for, it recognizes public relations, public affairs, and consumer education and excellence among motor vehicles, law enforcement, and traffic safety. And so just wanted to let everyone know that video actually won the Region 4 award. And then we have a new video that we're going to go ahead and show because it's not that long. But this is the newest video that's come out, and it's called Training is Everything. I can pass it around. But what it does, because the majority, I think it's like 65% of the accidents that are happening with motorcycles are the motorcycle driver's fault themselves. And so this focuses on the need to do training, and that not only when you get your endorsement do you have to go through some sort of training, but training is constant. And so it's there's some really good parts to the film that reinforces how important training is, like when you're flying a helicopter. I hope this one takes off as much as the other one.
Literally.
The other one that was focused on driver awareness around motorcycles was translated into multiple languages and got well over a million plus hits on YouTube. So we'll see how much this one gets. But we'll go ahead and show the video.
Absolutely love riding. My whole theory is straight lines for a delivery truck, not for a motorcycle.
It's my passion. It's where I get my head straight.
Motorcycle riding was something I did long before I started racing boats. I had a mini bike, and I had a track in my backyard, and I went around and around thousands and thousands of times.
Even if it's just riding home from work. It's a ride. Everybody loves a ride. love being a pilot. Flying is it's extraordinary, just being in the air and helping out the ground troops.
My earliest memory as a child was I wanted to be a race driver.
There's no 10-hour, they go pour on the power.
I wanted to be a successful race driver so bad, I left no stone unturned.
And Hanauer moves into first.
I love rugby. I fell in love with it the first day I showed up to practice. I started, and I never wanted to quit.
We're trying to hit each other as hard as we can.
You know, you're out there trying to learn your plays.
You're trying to not get hit.
Training is everything.
Well, training and consistent and repeated training is what helps you improve and helps you excel at what you do.
I would just run the boat, try different things, practice and practice. And then as I became a professional, well, that never ended.
You never quit training. We have simulators that we can train in, and we have classes that we have to attend. And it's just a constant. It really is.
We practice in season twice a week.
In practice, you wanna try and replicate what you're going to do in an actual game.
Like playing chess, you know, you're out there trying to learn your plays and figure out what you need to do to beat that opponent.
I was always asking everybody from my crew chief to the truck driver, you know, what did you see that you think I can do differently? I can do better.
Me riding a motorcycle, it's really on par with flying.
Riding is kind of an art. And every time you ride, you can do it better. You can learn something new.
I would say initially learning to hover was interesting because you're just learning about the helicopter itself, and then they tell you you have the controls, and then it's you doing it.
Motorcycles are a unique vehicle, just like a boat, a helicopter, a car. It's hard to jump on a unique vehicle with no training. And the challenge with motorcycling is, unlike a car, for example, you don't have the protection of an airbag or a roll cage or a seatbelt. And so any mistake you make is much more severe.
Training is everything.
A lot of times you're not consciously thinking. You want it to be intuitive.
You know that your skills are at that level where if something comes up out of the blue, that you're going to know what to do. You're just going to react instead of have to think and react.
Training is everything because you want to get to the point in your career where everything you've learned training-wise, it's an instinct.
Keep doing it, keep practicing so it becomes automatic, muscle memory.
You go and practice shooting baskets over and over again if you play basketball. You go catch a ball over and over again if you're going to play baseball.
I think anything that takes physical and mental skill requires training if you want to do it well.
And I think that we really all should be looking at it as a sport where we are always encouraging ourselves to improve our skills and become better.
For all kinds of reasons. One reason is it increases your enjoyment of riding.
It's totally more fun. It's totally more fun. The better technique you have, it's safer, but you can also get more out of you and more out of your bike.
Motorcycles, well, you're vulnerable. You're very, very, very vulnerable on a motorcycle. You need to be working on your game.
I was on my way to work one morning, and it was a little overcast. And I was taking a corner a little too quick, and I hit a wet spot, and I ended up high-siding and getting thrown over the front of the bike. And I hit a guardrail doing about 40. I broke my spine, my collarbone, left me paralyzed from the waist down. A common belief is that what causes motorcycle accidents are car drivers not being careful, not looking out for motorcyclists. A large percentage of motorcyclists are killed by motorcyclists because we go too fast into the corner. We don't have the skills to handle a bad situation.
You never quit training. the best advice I would give to anybody, whether you're a new rider, whether you're an experienced rider, is don't get overconfident. Because the moment you do, you leave yourself open for things to happen.
That's the difference between an accident and being safe.
I love riding. It's a dangerous sport. I want the best chance I have to be able to come home to my family. And then to ride some more.
Every minute you can be on a bike, I was on it and I loved it, so pretty much no better feeling.
Oh, I love it. I still love it. I'd ride now if I could.
So, hopefully that one will take off like the other one did. But thanks to the Traffic Safety Commission for our continued partnership and getting that. Even though motorcycles are not priority one, I think they're in priority two, aren't they, Darren?
They're in priority two.
Yeah. We still watch.
A common belief is that what causes motorcycle accidents are car drivers, not.
But David Weed, who is one of the driver or the motorcycle trainers.
He's in there.
Who you saw in here, fabulous. He actually did a workshop, I believe it was yesterday, on motorcycle riding, and he's really been really upbeat. He's excited. You know, he can tell he loves what he does, and he's very good at his craft. And we did a press conference a couple of weeks ago, actually about a month and a half ago, up in Kent, and David was there, and we had some of the folks, because there was some concerns about a motorcycle enforcement campaign that we were doing, and people thinking we were just targeting motorcycles, and which was obviously not the case, but we had that. But it was just neat to see how, you know, they've taken this really seriously and taken a kind of a whole new paradigm about how do we approach motorcyclists, and seeing the group here. So hats off to DOL for what you're doing there, and I think the one motorcycle video that you saw last year with the boy in the car and then the stop and kind of the like stop in time, there was somebody, I think, from one of the other countries that took it, and it had like 2.4 point something million hits internationally, and it was just like, oh my gosh. So there's lots of interest, and I think that this was kind of designed in a way, too, so that it's not just Washington-centric, that it can be used anywhere. So,
yeah, and I think I'm really underestimating the other video. I don't want to give a wrong number, but it's well over a million.
Taylor Swift numbers.
Yeah.
As I recall, it's over 5 million.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's really big. And then it got translated into all these other languages. And
so that brings me to just one question here, is if we had something that was on YouTube that got that many hits, isn't there some way that we get revenue back for that? I was just thinking that as a revenue stream back for DOL. You know, I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
So, but that was a great job. Great collaboration.
Yep, it was good. Okay, we're moving on next to the director's report by Darren.
Okay, well, we have just a few minutes left before we go into our, or we close, but just a few things. Is first, happy Bosses Day. So,
oh.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So, you're all my bosses. So, but I really appreciate you being here and making the effort to be here for the not only the commission meeting, but for some of the conference. We've had a fabulous 3 days here. We've had over 540 people register for this conference. Far exceeded our expectations for our first traffic safety conference. When I came in as the director, we had the impaired driving symposiums every year, and then we had the National DRE Conference. And so I saw kind of this, you know, large numbers of people. The impaired driving symposiums kept getting bigger and bigger, and then the tracks that we had kept expanding from law enforcement to then courts and probation and then the judiciary and, you know the judges. So I saw this thing kind of expanding and thought, you know what, we have an opportunity here and we've got the interest. Let's have a traffic safety conference. And so we have over 36 workshops that are here. Over the last 3 days. Hopefully at 11 you can sneak out and maybe go to the last 30 minutes of one of them. But we've had some great content, which covers education, policy, leadership. and licensing. One of the things that we've been really focusing on a lot is traffic safety culture and how that changes and how do we help change the culture in our own state so that it's not acceptable to ride without a helmet, where it's not acceptable for impaired driving, where it's not, well, you know, it's the cost of doing business, you know, where people have kind of this feeling of that, you know, that it's a social pariah that's, you know, a DOI instead of just, you know, somebody that got a DOI, what's the big deal, you know, they get a day in jail, and, you know, where we up that ante in our own culture and we address that. So we have talked about engineering, enforcement, probation, treatment, and public health that was part of that. We've had representatives from all kinds of different groups, prosecution and courts. We just had the distracted driving felony mock court that was across the hall here this morning with Dr. Bell and Amy Friedheim. So just some great things that have been going on here at the conference. When we set the dates, we set the hotel. One of the challenges I know that we're going to get back on is the parking, because there is nowhere to park. And so that obviously will be a consideration. Our hope is that we can do these every 2 years. They are very resource intensive, both on human capital and financially. But the big key for us is we'll have it this year. And this was a great kind of kickoff for us for next year's Governor's Highway Safety Association's annual conference. So all of the Governor Highway Safety representatives come in, plus all the, you know, advocates and many of their staff come in for a huge conference. And that's going to be at the Sheraton, and that's August 27th through the 31st. So this will be kind of our big kickoff as a state. We'll do a national one next year, which doesn't happen very often. And then in 2017 is when we will hope to do another traffic safety conference again, hopefully in the fall like we've done this year. Because it kind of takes us out of that conference session, or that season, and so that folks can come. We've had, I think we've, I don't know, 200 and something DREs that are here. We've got a lot of different representation from all the different disciplines within traffic safety, and I am just thrilled to see. When you go into the luncheon today, up front by the stage, there will be a table or tables for the commissioners if you're going to be staying for lunch, and I hope you are, because our keynote speaker today is Matt Richtel, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He works for the New York Times, but he's actually operating out of the San Francisco office. And I heard him speak last year, and he's phenomenal, just engaging, knows his stuff. And he wrote the book, A Deadly Wandering, which is about distracted driving, and a case that is actually out of Utah. And so we have purchased the books for the attendees, so please grab one down at the registration desk. There it is. Yeah, and he'll be available for book signings right after the luncheon. But just some really amazing things that have happened here. Just the interaction, the networking, just the interest. You know, I mean, when you see this many people in a state, I mean, this actually and the numbers outdo some of the national conferences that I have attended. And I'm just like, wow, this is of our own state. Shows one that there's a definite need and an interest for these kinds of conferences and to just have this kind of networking, but also it's a level of commitment, and I think that we have in this state that people they take the time and the resources to be able to be here for, really, it's 2.5 days, but over the 3 days, to be here, to be engaged. And I had a comment made to me yesterday after our keynote speaker was Nick Ward, the doctor from Montana State University on culture, and was a lieutenant from the patrol, and it was interesting. He came up to me and he says, you know, after all these years, I've never put it quite in this context. He says, that was really enlightening. And I was like, that's exactly what we want. You know, looking at things from maybe a little different perspective and a different paradigm, because that's sometimes we get kind of in our way of thinking is pull ourselves out, look at it differently, and how do we set up those different models. And so just excited.
I think one thing that he said that was really important too, though, is we're doing a lot of really good things, like
yes,
the enforcement side and some of the policies that we have in place. Don't quit doing that, but also look at it from this cultural standpoint.
you know, they talked a lot about like the fear versus more
behavior.
Yeah, more behavioral based. And so I think that was a really important lesson for me in his discussion, was you can't just do what he's suggesting without keep doing what we are doing, which are some really good things.
Yes. Yeah, the
Sorry,
sense
I didn't
of responsibility.
Mean to record, I just thought I should add.
Yeah, and then it was, yeah, it was the fear-based versus, you know, I think it was like the penalties. And but it was just really, I mean, just all of them, you know, from Volvo to Nick Ward to Dr. Reese, and then the gentleman that spoke yesterday who was the recovering alcoholic. Just to hear his story and that, I think, was quite, I mean, personally, just very enlightening. And so it's been a great conference. So I know a lot of people here. Hopefully we'll get some good feedback and we can get back out that to you. So make sure you stay for lunch. And then we'll conclude at 1 o'clock today. I just wanted to give you a heads up on the Tribal Traffic Safety Advisory Board that the Traffic Safety Commission has. That has been growing and expanding. When we brought the tribal leaders together and some of the representatives, we said to them, we don't want to just meet and talk about, you know, stuff. We want to actually have some very specific goals with some deliverables and things that we're actually helping you with. One of their very first requests was to create a tribal culturally relevant materials for education for the tribes. So we have just finished, and we're hoping at the end of this month we'll be able to release. We'll have videos from, we did a west side and an east side. We did a Squaxin Island tribe, and then at the Colville tribes, we had our videographer, contractor come out, and we focused on occupant protection. We talked about pedestrian safety, talked about DUI, distracted driving, and it's all tribal members. And with the exception of a couple that are emergency medical responders that are not tribal, but they work for the tribe, but for the most part, they're all tribal members. We will have RAC cards and information that's going to be going out that, you know, has kind of the tribal theme that they've helped to design and create. So we were more kind of brokering all of the, you know, the media for them, but they are thrilled about having their own messages and kind of talking to their own people in their way. We've got a guy from the Colvilles that did a song, and then he spoke about his own alcohol addictions, and it was really powerful. I mean, I stood there, you know, with the cameraman and that, and we were watching this, and then when you see it actually on video, you're like, wow. The video seemed to capture things that you don't see, you know, when you're there, and it was amazing to us, because like, do you remember saying that? And so it was great to see the actual group. The Chehalis tribe came up and did some songs over the background music and, you know, some of their cultural stuff. So officers, tribal officers, we brought in from different tribal agencies. We have lots of pictures with them together and kind of how they're working together so that we can get the sector equipment in so that we can actually start getting better data from the tribes, especially collision data. So we're making some headway with the tribes slowly, but we're actually getting there. The last week you saw it was 2 weeks ago, the new drug driving report that came out from the Governor's Highway Safety Association and the Foundation of Alcohol and Responsibility. If you haven't seen it, I hope I've sent it to all of you. I think it came out. But this report, we assisted as a board member or advisory panel member with this, and the contents of the report, how many have seen and actually have gone through it? Has anybody had a chance to go through it? Yeah. And this was not intended to, you know, place blame, but it's just really to identify what the issues are nationwide, looking at drug driving, looking at the chemistry and the epidemiology of drugs, what it is. And then there's quite an extensive literature review. Jim Headland, who used to be the head of research for NHTSA, helped write. He was the contractor on this report. And so he's got quite a bit of experience and background. But then they looked at the law enforcement piece, the prosecution piece, adjudication, sanctions from around the state. They looked at different education programs and then recommendations for states that may be looking at legalizing marijuana. As more of, you know, these are some challenges But these are some potential areas to kind of focus on and things that have been going on in Washington and Oregon, and, Colorado. And so this is one way to just help to communicate to the states what's going on. And this came out from, from a national level. NHTSA is also going to be doing a follow-up report. So this is kind of, I see this as one of those living documents that's going to continue to expand over time as legalization is considered in other states and the impacts that it is having on the communities. We are December 8th at the Great Wolf Lodge is going to be the partners meeting for the Strategic Highway Safety Plan. And so hope to have all of you there. The last time we did this, we had 180 plus people. I told Mike Gable that if he didn't have 200, I was going to send him back to DOL. But just kidding, Pat. But he's really excited. I think some of you saw his presentation on Tuesday. But we really are excited to see the level of enthusiasm and excitement. And that our plan this next SHSP is going to be a little different. Hopefully, it won't be so much text, as there will be more kind of infographics, so that it has more data and information in a more condensed process instead of just paragraphs. So there's some different formats that we're looking at so that it's more user-friendly for not just us, but just also for the public as well to see. Engaging the engineering community to be a part of this so that those engineering solutions and behavioral pieces are kind of mirrored together and not separate. So we've got a lot of new things. John's on the steering committee, along with Chris Medill, our deputy director, who's the steering committee on that. So that's going very well. It's a great process. Talked about that. As the chief was mentioning earlier, we are seeing, and I'm going to take a look at this both kind of on the bad side and the positive side, but we had 436 fatals in 2013. We went to 462 in 2014. And as of the end of September, we were at 425. And now I'm going to preface that as those are preliminary numbers. But if we stay on track the way we have, we're going to be close to 520, 525. Where we were, it was interesting when I went back and looked at all this, because I was thinking, yeah, we're holding pretty steady, and we were until June. In fact, we were one over where we were we were one less than we were last year in June. And July, August, and September were all over 50 fatalities per month. In September, we were at 68. It's the highest month we have ever had since 2008. And so, I think there's lots of things that are attributing to that. I think our weather is one of those aspects. The economy is another aspect. We've got our populations increased, vehicle registrations. I mean, there's a lot of different things. But when you look at the overall trend where we've been for the last 5 years, we're still kind of in that, we're still below, I think, what that average is. So I'm trying to take a positive approach at this, as well as not letting it be, kind of the sky is falling. But looking at this with this conference, perfect timing for us to really help us to recommit ourselves and refocus our energies and our resources to help us address these numbers to get us back onto that trend line where we want to be for reduction.
So, Darren, are we going to have a discussion? What we're doing, we're doing a lot of really good things right now,
yep.
But that's not making a difference, and we're way off from hitting our target zero by 2030. So are we going to have some sort of work session about, so what else can we do or should we be doing, because what we're doing isn't necessarily, it kind of like got to us a lot of, I think of this in 16 to 25 years old, it got to a lot of low-hanging fruit,
mm-hmm.
But now we're going to have to do some major kinds of things to get down to zero.
So when we go through and do the data analysis and break these down by causation and the types of vehicles, and location, so state routes, city streets, counties, will break all of that out and really help us to look at that. Because my concern is we kind of plateaued, do we have a spike, and then we go back down again. And so, but I want to make sure that we're on top of this and that we're ahead of the, whatever those trends are. Because nationwide, we are following what's happening nationwide. The only state that I've seen that is not is Tennessee.
What's happening is actually predictable. It was predictable. We were doing very well in terms of the trends going in the right direction. We were aided by the economy being a situation where people were driving a lot less. That's all on the upward rebound now. We got a lot more people driving, as Darren indicates. And unfortunately, we have states that are legalizing marijuana. It was predictable that we'd have to see a rise in incidents associated with marijuana and other drugs. And we are tracking our own situation here in the state of Washington too, with the help of Dr. Fiona Cooper. And marijuana-related incidents are topping alcohol-related incidents on our roadways. And we're very short-handed. As an agency, we are close to 100 troopers down on the front line. Other agencies across the state are very short-handed, so they pull their resources, for the most part, from traffic to handle other things that they just don't have the resources to handle. So a lot of these things are simply predictable. And as you mentioned, our population increases up, our registered vehicle increase is increasing. So we have a lot of things going against us that are the realities of our situation that will force us to think outside the box. How do we do exactly what you're saying? Continue to do what we're doing in terms of placing our resources and our monies in the right places and tackling the right issues, but we still have to become more innovative. The laws that we've passed recently have helped us a lot. We're now enforcing the open container law with marijuana, similar to what we did for alcohol, so that's going to help some. The texting is a very difficult law to enforce. It continues to be. And we're seeing a lot of distracted driving incidents that are related to fatalities on our roadways. We really don't know, bottom line, the number of distracted driving-related fatalities we're having because it's so difficult to detect. But it's a huge problem for us.
So part of the conundrum with Target Zero is that even though there may be population and vehicle miles traveled-related factors, we're not. You know, that framework doesn't really allow us to take that into consideration because if we're going to zero, you know, we're kind of taking on, even if we double our population, we're committed to zero. So the reason I asked why there are legislators visiting today is because I think this has got to be an opportunity to kick that discussion up and try to demand some things from the legislature that we maybe haven't gotten before. We know that it's a very, very difficult discussion having to do with random sobriety checkpoints, and it's something that this state has never had a really good track record of engaging in. But, you know, I don't know what will get us to that. I mean, I credit to this conference, I sat in on a really good presentation by a gentleman from England talking about how other developed countries, especially in Europe and Australia, deal with these issues and have better numbers than we do. And they have some tools that we don't have available to us, and the random sobriety checkpoints is a big one. So I hope, I agree with Pat, we have to, this is, whatever the factors are, and we need to still analyze those, but we also need to make use of this opportunity to do something. We're seeing the exact same thing in Spokane. We had 5 fatals in September alone in the city of Spokane. It was a terrible month for us. That's more than we've had in some years in Spokane. And there's a variety of factors. This, in my preliminary, looks into it. We have 5 bike and ped deaths this year, and we have at least 5 known DUI fatals. But then we have another, you know, 7 that aren't in either one of those categories. So it's a really tough situation.
And it just makes me wonder, you know, in some respects, you know, we look at some of these factors and variables, but it's like, you know, why? We haven't messaged anything different, or, you know, in the sense of, you know, go drunk and, you know, drink and drive and do all these things, but it's like, what has changed to see these types of increases, at least nationwide? And like in your city and some of the other jurisdictions, you know, why? You know, is it all just because of these, you know, some of these variables we talked about? Are there other factors that we're not attributing to that maybe we need to look at that we need to address?
That may be true. Drowsy driving may be a part of it. I think everything the chief mentioned is definitely a factor. But, you know, even if we get a really good handle on what the factors are with better data than we have in front of us right now, I think what we're going to find out is our current methods are vulnerable to kind of bottoming out and the kind of progress that they can make on those factors.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. One of the things we found out over the years is that we can approach it from a information-driven approach as we've done for years. It's the laws that we put on the books that are actually our best tool. And we've talked about the need for a DUI checkpoint situation. It's one of the most unpopular things when it comes to a political conversation. But is it the right thing to do? When you look at the other states who've implemented the programs and countries around the world who are executing it, it's helping them up to 22% in terms of saving lives. So we've had that hard conversation, but we found very low willingness politically to be supported by it. That's the difficulty of getting across that hump.
Yeah, there was a session yesterday that was on data and in technology, and one of the it was actually Collision Records that presented with my staff, and using some of those heat maps, they're creating some of these like almost like a dot map, and then they have those where based on frequency, it's the dots bigger or larger or smaller. What was interesting is I looked at that and I thought, I wonder if that's some way that you could look at, because I know that we've looked at sobriety checkpoints from the perspective of, can you identify specific areas where there's more DUI arrests and collisions and that kind of thing, so that you could articulate to, I think the one idea was, you have a search warrant for a particular area, but that, then that has its debate. But we've got to continue that process, because we're trying to employ all the proven strategies and evidence-based programs that are out there. The only thing that we haven't been able to do is the sobriety checkpoints. The Target Zero teams were our attempt to be able to offset the lack of having the sobriety checkpoints. But having roving the patrols with the sobriety checkpoints together, the states are seeing some significant reductions in fatal crashes involving. Because our fatals, 50% of our fatals are impaired drivers.
Yeah. And one of the couple things that we're looking at on the national basis is predictive analysis associated with collisions and knowing where your incidents are likely to occur based on historical data. And another one is looking at repetitive offenders and how do we address those folks, because it's generally your folks who have a track record of committing traffic violations or driving under the influence that are continually a part of the problem. So how do we actually somehow, like we do with probationary folks, pay attention to those folks and let them know that we're paying attention to you.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find a way to enter that door to do something about that. Be it sending letters to them periodically or what have you, to let them know that we're keeping an eye on you.
Well, one of the things that the Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council was working on was an actual white paper for the governor's office for review. And so what we would like to do is to consider, instead of having it come from WIDAC, is once we have got it and edited, that we'd have it come from this body as a request. So we're finalizing that. I think we can provide that to you potentially. It changes so much, and so we would like to at least have this body consider presenting that up for consideration. And all it would be is just, these are the pros and cons and recommendations to look at. And then legislative bodies are going to make, what they want from it. But just to have the commission itself, this is so important. This is one area that's so important. We have got to push this forward, at least for keeping in the conversation.
One other piece to throw in, and it kind of dovetails to what you were talking about with these trends, we're also going to need to look differently at the kind of substances that are actually influencing that impairment.
Right.
It's not just marijuana. It's the advent of opiates and opioids and sleep aids like Ambien and those kinds of things. And each of those presents a different kind of challenge than what we have traditionally, kind of gone after either on the
right.
on the enforcement side or on the public education side. Another piece, it seems to me, that we need to be really cautious of. We live in an incredibly message-rich environment. And the stuff that we put out becomes part of the background so fast. And I point out, the reader signs on the freeway as an example. When those were first out, I noticed those every single time. I on my drive up this morning, I had myself wondering, why didn't I see one of those? Really, it's just, I mean, they're there. I mean, they haven't physically gone away. It's just,
You mean the ones that tell you how fast you're going?
Oh, no, the highway advisory signs, Amber Alerts, we put on all kinds of stuff. I think we're over using them for
Pointing out a challenge of how, you know, just how important it is to,
how do you manage it?
To be strategic in how
we
use those things.
So every time you put up, you know, DUI, you know, patrols this weekend, you know, that's great to have that message out there, but if the message doesn't change, or if you don't see the DUI patrols last weekend got this many people, or you know something along those lines, there's no movement in that message.
Right.
There's no reason to pay attention.
Right.
And I think all of those are strategic challenges. But the other piece, I'll be quiet. But the other piece is on kind of the treatment end of the world, which is kind of how we want to get some of those repeat offenders off the road. Some of the drugs that are out there, particularly the opioids that are coming out, the prescription opioids, are very, very, very difficult to treat. And so even on that end of the world, we're going to have to look very, very intensely at how we're doing business and how we can do business differently, because we're just not having the success treating opioids that we did, even with marijuana or even with methamphetamine or cocaine. Very resistant.
And in the conversation we have about, you know, a deeper look should involve Dr. Cooper, our state toxicologist, because her shop tracks on the trends associated with what drugs are out there.
So just as one of the things that we have found very difficult for, you know, when you go in and look at our fatality analysis reviewing system, our FARS data, is that the FARS data itself only allows you to put in up to three substances. And usually those substances are the three highest that they find in the blood level.
Okay.
So marijuana may have a low level. It may be in the body, but it may not show up in the FARS data. So we have asked, and actually I wrote a letter to NHTSA in January of this year, asking them to, one, expand the box or the allowance to put in all of the substances that were found in the toxicology screen. And then also adding in what that level was. So if it was marijuana, 5 nanograms. If it's cocaine, whatever the measurement is of that. Not in the sense of getting to a per se limit, but looking at it from a perspective of how do we look at this nationwide so that, you know, states can see what's happening nationwide with drug driving. And that's one thing that we heard, I guess it was in May, no, it was in, I think it was in June of this year, no, it was July we were in D.C. for the meeting, and NHTSA says that they are working on that because that is a limitation.
Right.
I mean, if we're looking at drug driving, especially related to fatal collisions, and we can't add all that data, then that's problematic for us as a state or states in general. So we're trying to get them to add those additional features. So we've been pushing, other states are pushing, and then we were at this national expert panel, and every state said, we've got to have that. We've got to have some national database that helps us to start looking at this thing.
I would think, too, that it isn't just the individual drugs, but it's the combinations that are
occurring.
Yeah,
that is
amazing.
Yes,
that's
got
to be huge. I'm sorry, the whole idea of the information overload, I just remember things that stuck in my mind. There was a campaign years ago, and I don't know that we do it anymore. Maybe we do it, I'm not noticing it. The whole designated driver thing, you know? We don't see that much anymore. And maybe that should be emphasized, and it made my mind also go to public transportation. And the more public transportation we have, the fewer cars that are going to be on the roads, ideally. Or you're going to utilize the public transportation when you know you really shouldn't be getting in a vehicle. And of course, that goes to the transportation package. It's always a struggle. But, I mean, those are simplistic things, and they're kind of outliers, but they still affect what's happening here.
Well, we need to, and Pat recently brought this back to us in terms of the driverless cars that are on their way.
Yeah.
We need to be a part of being knowledgeable of that and pushing the importance of that, because that's going to help us save a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm.
In our attempts to get the target zero, that's going to be critical to us. And the reality of Target Zero is we knew all along when we set this goal back in 98, the closer we get to our goal, the harder it's going to get. And we're getting there, and it's getting harder. And the trends are turning against us in terms of a lot of things we've already talked about. So that's only going to get more difficult as we move forward.
So just one last thing, Commissioner, is we just hired the new Target Zero manager in Grant County. So we went through the process last year and the regionalization. We had our first round, we didn't have any applicants. This third round, we actually extended the timeline. We got three additional ones, had a really good process. And her name is Allison, last name just eludes me. But Josh Sainsbury, do you know Josh?
I do.
Josh,
he's talking to him.
Yeah, she's here with him, and so we'll introduce you. Very excited, very enthusiastic. So I think some of these things within your county, too.
Where did you advertise this?
It was on our WebEx.
Oh.
It's a state system for contractors. And then they actually went out, I think, locally, too. Josh can have tell you exactly how that went out. But they've hired her, and they're thrilled.
Good.
So, and then she'll be there working basically, for that full-time position. Target Zero manager, so she's starting to get to know everybody and some of the programs and some of the issues, so now you've got that extra.
Just maybe this is probably isn't interesting to anybody but me. Anyway, my daughter-in-law, or my kids live down in Los Angeles, and she just took a new job. She's been with an engineering company for years, and they do designs for freeways and blah, 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 and this and that. Anyway, she's now working for the city of Los Angeles on this project, which was just crazy because I said, we're doing that. So we're going to share some of the information.
Awesome.
I was thinking about sending her this, so that they can see what we're doing up here. But it'd be interesting to see how Los Angeles is handling some of this stuff.
They have a major problem.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Anything else, Darren?
No, I'm
okay with that. With that, can I have a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed to adjourn?
Well, I wouldn't. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.